Welcome to the Dr. Mike Show. Well Mind with Dr. Mike. It's great to have you here again. We have a great guest today talking with us today about relationships and couples. He is a couples therapist working in San Luis Obispo. His name is Dan Conroy, and his website is danielconroy.com. Welcome, Dan, to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Mike. Good to be here with you.
It's great to have you. Yes, you're well known in the San Luis Obispo area in California for being somewhat of a master at doing couples therapy. How long have you been working with couples?
Well, quite a long time, actually. I think as an area of specialty, it's been about 31 years right now, and I've been in practice, I'll add another 10 on top of that, but actually what got me very interested in doing couples therapy was that my wife and I got into couples therapy as a couple, and I came out of that experience realizing it's a fairly powerful treatment modality, and so I took it on as a specialty at that point.
I see. Okay. Well, that's great. Well, you know, relationships are so central to our well-being, and obviously our relationship with our spouse or our partner, our life partner, is probably the most important relationship of our life, wouldn't you think?
Well, it is, you know, and it's an interesting thing, Mike, as a template for how we position ourselves in a relationship. Very often, the kind of attachment that we have with our partner bears the signature of the sort of attachment we may have had with our significant caregivers, moms, dads, early on in our life. So one of the things I'm always interested in when working with my couples is to make sure that the sense of attachment between partners is reliable. And one way I think about that is that when couples say, okay, so what is this business about attachment? What is it really all about? What I tell them, it's basically having the state of mind of being largely, not perfectly, but largely available and responsive to your partner. And if you understand that, then you don't have to go ahead and read all that literature on attachment theory. You're basically available and responsive to your partner. And there are a number of different styles of attachment that individuals have. If things go really, really well in our early lives, we might say that we have a sense of secure attachment, which means that we're really, really comfortable with closeness in a relationship, and our level of anxiety around closeness is really quite low. So if you identify yourself as a person who is securely attached, or you have such a person as your partner, consider yourself to be truly fortunate. Now, there are a couple of other styles of attachment as well that are worth talking about. One is to be anxiously attached, and that has two flavors. You could have an anxious avoidant attachment style, and these are partners who typically would avoid conflict, would find it very, very difficult to voice their opinion and so forth. And you also have other folks who are considered to be have an anxious preoccupied attachment style. What does that look like? That looks like Woody Allen on steroids. Someone who is continuously worried about the status of the relationship. And in the course of couples therapy, what we're trying to do basically is move both partners toward being more securely attached with one another. So if there's a general theoretical orientation that I have, it's probably rooted in attachment theory, and I can later on give a couple of suggestions for readings and so forth for the listeners if they're interested in pursuing that a bit further.
Sure. So if people are lucky and they had really healthy parents, then they probably were loved and developed a healthy, secure attachment with their parents. And then it's almost like learning to ride a bike. They learned how to be in loving relationship and carried that capacity in them, with them into their couples relationship. Is that right?
That's exactly correct. Now, you know, the thing is about couples therapy is it's a process by which couples can actually get the attachment largely repaired, and so the relationship itself becomes a forum in which you can actually become a much more complete and whole human being. So, you know, very often when couples come in the door, they're coming in for really one of two reasons. Either there have been angry, escalating conflicts that have destabilized the relationship. So these are the couples who it makes you wince when you're having dinner next to them in a restaurant. The gloves come off, no holes barred, lots of destabilizing conflict going on. Flip side of the coin is I'll get a lot of couples coming in where the relationship is significantly de-energized. They're conflict avoidant or conflict minimizing, and it turns out that there's a whole group of issues, decisions, and so forth that never really get successfully addressed. So in both those scenarios, what you're trying to do is to develop the capacity for these couples to be A, available and responsive to one another, and B, curious and interested about what makes the other person tick.
So being available and responsive, learning to be available and responsive, and curious and interested in the experience of your partner.
Those are
really great skills. And what's ironic you're saying is that if you develop those skills, those connection skills, those love skills with your partner, you actually feel more whole in the process of these healthy connections you make. Is that right?
That's exactly correct. So we're looking, basically, as a therapist, I'm looking to help couples heal a relationship, but then to be able to create a relationship that heals. So those two things to get a
relationship. It goes both ways.
It works both ways, right? And when I say a relationship that heals, what I mean by that is that if the relationship is fairly securely attached and you're developing the skills to see your partner as a separate individual human being, what happens, the magic out of that is you actually end up shifting your attachment style in the direction of being far more securely attached yourself. So the relationship can be healed, but then the relationship itself becomes a growing medium. Think of it as a growing medium for the ongoing development of two healthy individual identities. It's kind of a growing medium.
It's almost like the relationship helps you to heal yourself, but also you not only develop this capacity to be interdependent or connected and part of something greater than yourself, which is the couple,
right,
but also the ability to be part of a couple helps you to be more autonomous and independently whole as well. Is that true?
That's exactly the paradox. There are some people who come in really worried that if they get significantly involved with their partner, somehow they will become engulfed. And these are folks who typically encounter a partner from a significant emotional distance. And when that person becomes a bit more securely attached, what they're able to do is to recognize their partner as a separate autonomous individual in the world while maintaining their own separate sense of identity at the same time.
Yes, it is a paradox, isn't it, to be sort of interdependent and autonomous at the same time.
Right, and that's actually one of the keys in doing couples therapy. Let me just back off a little bit and describe some stages that couples typically go through. So if we think about the initial stages in a relationship, try and think about maybe the first 6 months, the first year. If you're in a relationship, think about the first 6 months, the first year that relationship was new to you. There's a sense of intoxication.
Right.
A sense of discovery. Similarities are emphasized. Differences are minimized, and it feels as if you have found your soulmate. It's interesting. The language that we use to describe that stage of development, it's the language of madness. You know, I'm crazy about you. I've lost my mind over you. Interestingly, the language we use does not talk about deciding to be in love. We fall in love.
Right.
So there's this sense of being kind of tumbled. I'm head over heels. And there's some neurobiological underpinnings for this, by the way. There's a wonderful neurotransmitter called dopamine, which basically lights up the pleasure and reward circuitry in our brain. And upon seeing or even thinking about our partner, we are flooded with this wonderful dopamine bath. There is a hormone called oxytocin that's secreted by the pituitary gland that facilitates attachment and bonding. So if you're wondering why you're so crazy at the front end of a relationship, it's because your brain is bathed in oxytocin and dopamine. So this goes on for a period of time, and it turns out that this period of intense bonding has a specific purpose, and the purpose is to dial in the relationship, to really cement an attachment so that the future challenges can be more easily navigated. So there's stage one. Let me move to stage two. Stage two is when we begin to notice, once the acute sense of intoxication has worn off, what we notice is the emergence of areas of difference between us and our partner. Who's more socially outgoing? Who's more shy and retiring? Who's more risk tolerant? Who's more risk avoidant? Whose sexual energy is calibrated at a particular level or a particular set point? And it is at those points when you begin noticing the areas of difference, when couples can do one of two things. They can either lean into the awareness of those differences and see the discovery of those differences as a valuable learning experience, or they can go in a different direction. And the different direction is they could end up with angry, escalating conflicts around those differences, or the opposite, which is kind of sweeping everything under the rug in order to avoid any possible disruption in the relationship. So a lot of my work with couples has to do, A, with getting the attachment strengthened in the relationship, and then on top of that, developing the capacity to navigate the awareness of those differences in a way that sheds more light than heat on the relationship.
Yeah, so using the differences as an opportunity in a way to learn about and appreciate each other and somehow learn to accommodate those differences is what you're saying. Is that right?
That's correct. And I should add that there are a couple of exceptions here. You know, if a partner is coming home drunk or high or completely unreasonable, okay, it's not okay. That's a benign area of difference. What the heck? I guess I have to be curious and interested about it. There are certain things that are obviously off limits and need to be addressed as such. But the awareness of the benign differences that couples will bring into a relationship, that is not only an opportunity to know your partner better, but it's also an opportunity to get to know yourself on a deeper level. I've been married for 35 years now, and one of the differences in my relationship is that my wife is absolutely wonderful at rapidly assessing a situation and proposing action. She's the best in the business. My strength is a bit different. I tend to be a bit more deliberative. My pace of decision making is not as rapid as her, and over the years we've managed to accommodate both. Now, what I should tell you is that early on in the relationship, it was a different story. She could see me as being glacial in my decision making, and I could see her as being impulsive. Neither of which was correct. Those were complete mischaracterizations. But I'm just offering that as a way to think about some areas of difference that can actually be rather complementary in a relationship. And as long as the awareness of those differences is not weaponized, couples will be in good shape.
Weaponizing differences, that's a really great term, something to be avoided.
So another thing that I often do talk about with my couples is to be very much aware of their own triggers, their own emotional triggers, and to be very much aware of their partner's emotional triggers as well. I would invite the listeners just to sit back for a moment and consider those areas of particular psychological vulnerability that each of you may have. It may be sensitivity to criticism. It may be sensitivity to the perception of not being competent. There may be an area of particular sensitivity when your partner is less than available. So there's something about knowing what those areas of vulnerability are, both within oneself and within in one's partner, that can be enormously helpful by way of avoiding triggering your partner into a state of emotional reactivity.
Right. So really being aware of people, of each other's buttons, and being just careful out of care and love.
A lot of times couples say, okay, so what are some of the component parts of really being an effective partner? The main one that I describe is the ability to self-calm, the ability to self-regulate one's internal states. So we could say that a significant prerequisite for any successful relationship is the individual partner's ability to self-calm when things are really distressing. A lot of couples kind of think that their partner has the responsibility to communicate effectively, kindly, humanely, supportively. And what I'll often point out to partners is that couples therapy is a lot less about getting your partner to behave in a particular way and a lot more about being able to develop the capacity as a partner to be able to be more effective. So on this business of self-regulation, one of the first things we think about is what happens when you really get angry, right? What happens when you feel really, really pushed? And one of the things we know is that if you engage in a major conversation at a time when you're really feeling emotionally angry and reactive, good things will not happen. So one of the things we like to have couples do, if you're feeling really angry, if your heart rate is up and running, the respiration may be short and shallow, to give yourself a timeout. And there's a way to do this and a way not to. The way to do it would be to tell your partner, look, I simply can't be talking about this at the moment. I need to back off. And by prior agreement, a couple can say, okay, if one of the other decides, okay, I can't talk about this right now, I'm way too escalated, that has got to be an okay thing to do. It's not abandonment. It's not dereliction of duty. It's not going AWOL. In this example, what you're trying to do is back off enough to give you and your partner a bit of breathing room. So this is what we call anger management 101, the ability to take a break, to breathe deeply, and to let that break be at least a half hour before you rejoin the conversation. There's a lot of research that shows if you try and re-engage a conversation having taken a time out, if that 20-minute time frame has not been observed, there's a good likelihood that the conflict is going to get a lot more escalated than it would have had that break never happened. So that's absolutely critical. I'm curious, Mike, in your work with folks in recovery and so forth, anger management, my guess, is a fairly central part of your work. What is that like?
Yeah, absolutely, Dan. I think that what's similar in our work with my patients who suffer from addiction and perhaps your work with couples is that a lot of my patients cannot tolerate painful emotions, whether it be anger or loneliness or anxiety or boredom or depression. And so because they don't have secure attachments to help them self-regulate, use other people to manage how they feel, they use drugs or alcohol to self-regulate. So I think we're both sort of in the business of helping people to learn how to manage their emotions, whether it be anger or other emotions. And I think that in addition to taking a time out, if somebody has somebody close in their life that they trust and respect, to be able to talk it out with somebody who is not going to sort of side up with you and say, oh, what your partner did was so terrible, but help you to sort out your own feelings about it and get some clarity so that you then can loop back to your partner with a little bit more clarity. I think that can be very helpful. I don't know, do you ever recommend that?
Oh, yeah, frequently. If there are people who, how would I describe this? I think if you think about people who are in your life whose judgment you trust, whose intentions are loving and good, you could say that in the presence of those people, you feel seen, soothed, and secure. The three S's, seen, soothed, and secure. And in order to turn towards such a person, the prospect of turning towards such a person can really have a massively calming effect. In fact, there's even portability where that's concerned. So I might say that if I'm in a really anxiety-provoking situation, I can actually mentally evoke the image of a person with whom I feel a sense of trust and secure attachment. And what research tells us that is actually going to have a physiologically calming impact on me. So, there is a lot to be said for that. And in fact, within the framework of couples work, often what I'm doing is telling couples to develop the capacity to turn toward one another in order to have moments of psychological meeting that actually calm both partners down. It's also interesting, if I think about people who are in recovery, I think that's some of what they might get at a good solid 12-step meeting, that there are other people who may understand what their dilemmas are, understand the vulnerabilities involved with turning towards substances. And there's just something about that process that I think holds the prospect not only for strengthening relationships, but also strengthening sobriety. So there's a kind of a double benefit to be had there.
Yes, the stronger your relationships, the stronger your sobriety, and the stronger your sobriety, the stronger your relationships.
Oh, you know what? I'm going to steal that for use with clients. I'm going to steal that word for word. That's great.
Well, thank you. So you're listening to Dr. Dan Conroy, Master Couples Therapist. This is the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. We're happy to have you, and stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show. We're very fortunate today to have Dan Conroy with us, a couples therapist from the San Luis Obispo, California area. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Mike. Glad to be here.
You mentioned people having sort of an anxious or insecure attachment style.
Correct.
Are there other kinds of attachment styles? And if so, a couple questions about those. What are those attachment styles, and then how do they affect the nature of the couple's relationship? And then the third question would be, given whatever your attachment vulnerability is,
right,
what is the work like that you need to do to heal that?
That's a great question. That's a good question. Okay. So we've already talked about, I want to outline five attachment styles. One we talked about in the last segment, the secure attachment style. So this is a partner who has a high level of toleration for proximity, for emotional proximity in a relationship, and a very low level of baseline anxiety. So they're comfortable being close, and they feel pretty much at home with that. So let me outline four others. There is something called a dismissive attachment style. Now, this sounds almost paradoxical. After all, why would a person who's dismissive seek attachment? Well, you know, the secret is everybody seeks attachment. And the question is, what attachment style is activated once the attachment takes place? So the joke that I sometimes tell my clients is, you know what a dismissive attachment style is if you've ever been involved with an engineer. And at that point, I have to apologize to all the engineers out there. This is simply a kind of a stereotype. But a dismissive attachment style is somebody who has a high level of emotional avoidance. These are people who are cool cucumbers. They seem to be largely unaffected by the swirl of emotions around them. They seem to be oddly unaffected by situations that would get other people either quite sad or quite joyous. Think Spock from Star Trek. You may think about that as an example. So a high level of emotional avoidance and a very low level of anxiety, meaning these folks are actually comfortable with that level of emotional detachment. They tend to be dismissive, hence the name, dismissive of other people's emotional states. So the question then is, for a person with a dismissive attachment style, what is the work in front of that person in couples therapy? Well, for one thing, it has to do with being able to increase their toleration for emotional closeness. And in practical terms, what that means is helping that person with the dismissive attachment style to develop the capacity to bear witness to their partner's emotional states without the fear of being engulfed by those emotional states.
Right, right.
So for that person, the ability to be curious and interested about what makes the partner tick. And what I can predict is that as that dismissive partner becomes more familiar or more tolerant of closeness, their anxiety level might actually rise. So my job in that situation is to help them to regulate their anxiety level while developing the capacity to be more involved, to bear witness without taking ownership, to bear witness to their partner's attachment styles. Let's talk about two other kinds of attachment. There is the anxious avoidant person. So these would be people who you would think, to look at them, you would think that there's perhaps not a lot going on underneath the surface. They seem to be pretty well self-contained. In fact, once you talk to them, what you find out is there is a significant area of anxiety that they have about attachment. And as a result, they tend to get very timid. They will often avoid close attachments. I've seen a good number of clients who were subjected to adverse childhood experiences. For example, child abuse, child neglect, parental substance abuse, who as a result have learned that to be in close proximity with someone is to run the risk of having something really destabilizing happen, so that they end up with a high level of avoidance of closeness, and underneath that, a high level of anxiety. So let's talk about the path ahead for an anxious, avoidant person. It really has to do with being able to increase the level of toleration for proximity while managing their own anxiety. In other words, a lot of times these are folks who get very much worried, not about engulfment, but about the opposite, about abandonment. So they have developed psychologically self-protective mechanisms to keep themselves at a distance. On the inside, they're often dying with loneliness, and by the time you get a couple of layers down in the couples therapy, you'll find that they actually have a tremendous desire, without the capacity, but a tremendous desire for increased closeness. So this anxious, avoidant person, if we want to move them more in the direction of being secure, they need a lot of assurance along the way, from their partner, actually, that to be more revealing of the dimensions of themselves to their partner, they actually result in a warm welcome. And when folks who are anxiously attached realize that, a lot of times they reach for the tissues, there's a lot of tears involved, and there can be a significant sense of relief for them as a result.
So that must be beautiful to witness.
Yeah, it's quite moving. It's quite moving to witness, and it's a bit like seeing a couple of tulips coming up under the snow in the springtime. So that's good stuff. So we've talked about secure attachment. We've talked about dismissive attachment. We've talked about anxious avoidant attachment. Let me give you two others. There's one called an anxious preoccupied attachment style, and we've described that before as being like Woody Allen on steroids. These are people who are quite clingy and have a very high level of anxiety. Partners describe them as being flypaper. They can be really, really, really off-putting with a lot of questions about whether the partner is really okay. I see your expression is kind of off. I'm wondering, are you really mad at me? No, you're saying you're not mad at me. There's got to be something else going on. They can really, really be difficult to deal with. Once that person, that anxious, preoccupied person, begins to recognize that 24/7, 365, lighthouse-like awareness of other people's internal states may have been the very state of mind that kept them safe as kids, but paradoxically enough, can drive away a partner, resulting in yet more anxiety on their part. When they actually get that, you'll notice a moment of calming. Now, you're not trying to tell them not to be observant. And a lot of times these are people with great interpersonal awareness skills, but the anxiety load that goes along with that can really make the situation, paradoxically enough, result in the very kind of distance that they so fear. So the developmental path for this anxious, preoccupied person is actually A, learning how to manage their anxiety internally, some self-calming going down, and then being able to tolerate their partner's fluctuating emotional states without feeling as if those fluctuating emotional states are proof positive that they're about to be abandoned.
When we
come back from a break, I'll describe one more attachment style that's perhaps the most difficult of all.
Okay, that sounds great.
Yeah.
You're listening to Well Mind with Dr. Mike. We have Dan Conroy with us, a master couple therapist from San Luis Obispo, California. We appreciate your listening, and we'll be back in just one moment. Welcome back to Well Mind with Dr. Mike. We're very fortunate today to have with us Dan Conroy. a master couples therapist who lives and works in San Luis Obispo, California. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here.
Now, you had mentioned that there are five different attachment styles. There's a healthy
Correct.
One, secure attachment, and then there's dismissive attachment, and then there's anxious avoidant, and then
Right.
there was anxious sort of clingy, I think.
Yeah, anxious preoccupied.
Anxious preoccupied. What's the fifth attachment style?
Okay, so put on your seatbelts. Here we go. The fifth attachment style, and one that is enormously difficult to work with, is called a disorganized attachment style. And what this means is that you have a person who basically blips back and forth between being clingy on the one hand, angry, and enormously difficult on the other. Now, this is not to say everybody who gets angry has a disorganized attachment style. Sometimes these folks are referred to as having a quote-unquote borderline personality disorder. And just to be technically correct about this, a borderline personality disorder means that you have a person who has underlying terrifying fears of abandonment and will try and manage those fears of abandonment by either making unreasonable demands on the one hand or getting incredibly angry when those unreasonable demands are not met. They tend to be, in fact, there's even a joke among therapists, which is, you know, how do you treat such a person? And the answer to that is with a referral. and the reason a lot of therapists are really anxious about dealing with such people is because everybody's anxious around dealing with people who have a disorganized attachment style. So what's the developmental task in front of somebody who blips between high levels of avoidance and anger and flipping over into an awful lot of clingy, dependent behavior? The first has to do with developing the capacity for internal self-calming. And one way such a person can do that is to begin to, in a mindful way, simply notice those times when they may be tempted to bail out of a relationship, when they may be tempted to fly into a rage. One of my clients who developed a nice capacity to manage this described it as watching the temptation to default into flat-out rage pass like a squall in the distance without running over to get his head wet underneath. So this is where mindfulness techniques come in enormously helpful. In couples therapy, people with disorganized attachment styles a lot of times can get some significant level of relief if they have a partner, A, who's willing to be available and responsive to them. But then that person with the disorganized attachment style also has to recognize that they have some responsibility in the matter as well. And a lot of times this is a very tough sale to make, but that person actually has to realize that they are contributing in one way or another to the very conditions in the relationship about which they subsequently complain. So this is a matter of taking some significant responsibility for one's stance in the relationship. Very often with couples, you will notice that they can get into these destructive, mutually reinforcing, self-sustaining negative feedback loops, where one is complaining about abandonment in such a way that might actually push away the partner, who goes into a well-defended retreat, which further precipitates the first partner's fears of abandonment, on and on it goes. Most couples have some form of a mutually reinforcing, self-sustaining negative feedback loop. In couples therapy, what we try and do is to outline the contours of those feedback loops and then work hard to re-choreograph it. So couples often get a great sense of relief, actually, by recognizing that the relationship itself is not necessarily the problem. The problem is the problem, and the problem is the presence of these feedback loops that go back and forth, back and forth. A couple of classics would be someone who is quiet and avoidant, with the other person being critical and complaining, and one can actually ping off the other. If you can slow that down enough and invite the couple to re-choreograph it, you'll learn a lot of times that you can get really beneficial results out of that. So we talked about these attachment styles. where the different attachment styles need to move in order to gain ground. We've also talked a little bit about these feedback loops.
Thank you, Dan. You know, I've seen situations in a couple where there was sort of the identified problem in the couple, and the other person feeling that they were perfect and that there was nothing wrong with them, that it was all the other person's fault. And after endless years of couples therapy, without any kind of acknowledgement that maybe what's going on is the dynamic between two people, having the couples therapy fail, how do you address intractable couples difficulties, and how do you know when to tell a couple that it's just not going to, or do you ever tell a couple, I don't think it's going to work for the two of you?
No, I do not, and I have a pretty strong feeling about this. I think that it is no therapist's business to tell a couple that they should abandon ship. I think a lot of times, if you hear that from a couples therapist, you're probably dealing with a couples therapist whose own anxiety level or lack of preparation for handling a difficult couple is such that in order to calm themselves down, they pronounce the relationship beyond repair. So I don't do that. My assumption is that if I have a couple in the room with me, there is enough energy and intention on their part to get the relationship going in a better direction.
So you never give up hope then?
Yeah, exactly. The very fact that they're in the room. And sometimes, you know, I'll ask them, listen, I want to take temporary custody of your hopelessness. Give it to me. I'll hand it back if at some point you'd like it. But for right now, I want to take temporary custody of your hopelessness. We're going to move forward to see if we can gain some ground here. And very often that has to do with really appealing to each that couples therapy is not about partner reform. I have no skills, actually, for reforming a partner. I have a few skills for helping partners to be far more effective in their relationship as partners. So each individual gaining capacity to be a more effective partner, that's a huge part of couples therapy. But again, to answer your question, I think it would be incredibly presumptuous on my part to declare a relationship beyond the point of beyond the point of repair. Now, that said, you know, there's been an awful lot of research on couples, and one of the really troubling predictors for the future of a relationship is when the sense of fondness and admiration on both parts has gone. If the fondness and admiration has left the building and has left the building for quite a while, it's not necessarily the kiss of death, but that's a relationship that is really on very, very thin ice indeed. So I'm talking about relationships where there is a high level of loneliness and isolation, and it has defaulted into the equivalent of two parallel lives going on under the same roof, with very few points of connection. Even in those situations, I would not pronounce a couple beyond the point of repair, because I've seen a lot of those couples actually fight their way back toward a level of availability, responsiveness, and repair that is actually quite remarkable.
When you say fondness and admiration, I think of two people liking each other. And if two people don't like each other, then it would seem to be it's part of your work to help them to find a way back to appreciating.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, what I often tell them at the very beginning is, look, a fly on the wall observing a really high-functioning couple, that fly on the wall would conclude one thing, and that one thing is that these two people are really good friends. That's what the fly on the wall would conclude. And so being able to regain a sense of humor, a sense of self-deprecating humor, a sense of humility within the relationship, that's the makings of a relationship that actually has a sustainable future.
Well said. You're listening to Well Mind with Dr. Mike with Master Couples Therapist Dan Conroy. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Well Mind with Dr. Mike. This is Dr. Michael McGee with you. We're fortunate to have Dan Conroy with us, a master couples therapist from San Luis Obispo, California. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about healing and repair, if we could. How do you go about getting back on track after a troublesome conflict or after there's been harm that's been done to one or more people in a couple?
Okay, that's a great question, and this is one of the arrows in your quiver that you absolutely have to have in order. Well, that's an unfortunate metaphor, isn't it? This is one of the skills. This is one of the skills that you need to develop in order to have a successful relationship. Why is that? It's because every successful relationship has oscillations of close attachment, disruption, and repair. Close attachment, disruption, and repair. So these disruptions, the misunderstandings, the misfires, those are absolutely predictable, and we have to anticipate that those will take place. So what do you do when you really blow it? Okay, so there's actually a formula for this. So the formula is accountability without humiliation equals repair. Accountability without humiliation equals repair. So if I really blow it with my partner, I want to be accountable for my behavior. And that needs to be unilateral. There's no quid pro quo. So let me give you an example of what it sounds like. I show up a half hour late for dinner with my wife. She has no idea where I am. I have not texted her. And she is pretty well fuming about that. Afterwards, I might say, you know, I absolutely blew it by showing up 30 minutes late without letting you know what had happened. I can't imagine what that must have been like to be there with guests, no idea of where I was. And moving forward, what I want to do is a much better job of keeping close tabs on the schedule so that that never happens again. Please notice what I've done there. I've been accountable. It's without humiliation. I'm not eating the rug or throwing myself on the ground at her feet. I'm imagining what it would be like to be her in that situation, and I'm committing myself moving forward to being more effective. A lot of people get into big trouble when they'll say, yeah, I was late, but let's face it, there's a bunch of times you've been late too. All that does is it waters down the responsibility that one is taking, and it basically creates the conditions for your partner to feel not understood, but to feel defensive. So it's accountability minus humiliation equals repair. And if you're on the receiving end of such a repair, there's two words you need to be aware of. Thank you. That's it. Thank you. You just allowed the thank you to sit right there in the air, and you can assume that a graciously accepted thank you for a repair gesture is something that will actually strengthen the attachment in the relationship. I'm a big believer that an effective repair actually leaves the relationship stronger than it was before the repair took place. And if you're like
me, that's a good point, right? We should accept that conflict is going to happen.
Yeah.
In a relationship. And it seems like what makes a relationship strong is not the absence of conflict, but the ability to resolve conflict and come out on the other side, like you said, with accountability and
Accountability is absolutely essential, and it's basically telling your partner that he or she matters, that you have some idea of what it might have been like to be on the receiving end of you being less than an effective partner at that point. It's actually what parents do with kids, right? So a parent might make an assumption about a kid's state of mind, gets it wrong, and says, oh, okay, wait a second, hold on, I think I had that wrong. So what happens there is that the repair, it's like a surgical repair that leaves a fracture stronger than the surrounding bone. You can think of it in those terms.
Oh, nicer, yeah, stronger in the broken places. That's nice.
Exactly.
I think the other side of what you said in addition to accountability is sometimes you see partners who go into the humiliation side of things and say, oh my God, what I did was so terrible. I'm such a terrible person. I'm such a jerk. I hate myself.
Right, and that person at that point is trying to inoculate himself or herself against getting further criticized. And it leaves the recipient of that repair completely flat-footed. I don't know what you're supposed to say to that. If, on the other hand, you can look your partner square in the eye and say, you know what, honey, I blew it. I should not have done that. And
it takes the focus off the person who was aggrieved.
Exactly.
And the person making the focus on them and how awful they are.
Right.
When really the whole point of making amends is to have empathy for the person that you've harmed.
Right. That's the accountability part of it. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Very good. Well, good. Well, I'm sure, I mean, you've been doing this for 30 to 40 years. I'm sure you probably have a lot of pearls of wisdom that you've learned along the way from couples that you work with.
Well,
would you like to share some of those?
I do, actually, and a good obsessive person that I am has actually kept a list. And I always ask my clients permission, is it okay that I can jot this down for use with other clients? So just to let you know, this is in no way a violation of anybody's confidentiality, but if you come to mind, One man in working in couples therapy, when he finally got that the couples therapy was designed to make room for two different personalities, he looks at me and he says, oh, okay, I get it. One canvas, two artists. One canvas, two artists. So what's the canvas? The canvas is the attachment that they had created in the relationship. And the two artists, the different brush strokes, those bear the signature of the two individuals who are, in an ongoing way, creating the work of art that was his relationship. So, one canvas, two artists. Another one that comes to mind, the client once told me, oh, okay, I have to take personal responsibility for the kind of relationships I want to have. So this is a person who used to think that it was just dumb luck. That you got lucky or unlucky in selecting this, that, or the other partner. This is a person who finally developed the idea that, okay, I have to take personal responsibility for what? For creating the best partnership contribution I can make. Personal responsibility for the kind of relationships I wish to have. Let me go through another couple
That's
of
great.
Gems that I've gotten. Quote, I need to communicate better with myself. I need to communicate better with myself. So what does this mean? This means here's a person who actually has to take internal stock, take the measure of his internal state before he initiates a discussion with the partner. This is a person who has concluded that he cannot simply assume that the partner is going to understand him by virtue of being in the relationship, but he first needs to communicate better with himself. Another couple, I asked another one of my couples what were a few of the things that they would look at as strengths. So let me wrap up with this. Here's what you
Sure, let's wrap up with one more.
A strength in our relationship. We both try to do little things that may otherwise be unexpected, and thank one another for the normal activities. So this is developing a culture of gratitude within the relationship, which will go an awful long way when somebody is feeling frustrated or worried about the state of the relationship. Creation of a sort of a culture of gratitude within the relationship.
Yes, and a great attitude to have, and one to end on, which is my gratitude to you, Dan, for taking so much time out of your busy day to share your wisdom with us. Just wonderful.
Yeah, this has been an absolutely delightful conversation, Mike, so I'm happy to be part of it.
Yeah, thank you so much. You've been listening to the Well Mind with Dr. Mike show, with Dr. Michael McGee here, with Dan Conroy, and you can learn more about Dan and his brilliant work at danielconroy.com. Thank you again, Dan.
Okay, take care, Mike.
You too, take care.